Hello, and welcome to this audio edition of Philip Huscher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparola. Concerts by the CSO on Thursday, February 20th through Saturday, the 22nd, feature guest conductor Dame Jane Glover and violin soloist Stella Chen. The program includes Sir Edward Elgar's Serenade for Strings, Vaughan Williams' The Lark Ascending with Stella Chen, Benjamin Britten's A Suite on English Folk Tunes, A Time There Was, once again with Stella Chen, Tzigan by Ravel, and concluding the program, the London Symphony No. 104 by Haydn. Here are Philip Huscher's program notes on Vaughan Williams' The Lark Ascending, Romance for Violin and Orchestra, a work lasting about 13 minutes. From the beginning of his career, in the first years of the 20th century, Ray Vaughan Williams was seen as a composer rooted in the past. His first significant large-scale work, The Fantasia on a Theme of Thomas Tallis, composed in 1910, is indebted to the music of his 16th-century predecessor and to the great English tradition. His entire upbringing was steeped in tradition. He was related both to the pottery Wedgwoods and Charles Darwin. Quote, "The Bible says that God made the world in 6 days," his mother told him. "Great Uncle Charles thinks it took longer, but we need not worry about it, for it is equally wonderful either way." He became a serious student of English folk song and edited the English hymnal. Even the experience of studying with Ravel in 1908, which clearly enhanced his understanding of color and sonority, only served to sharpen his own individual style and to ground him more firmly in the sensibilities of his musical heritage. Years later, Ravel would call him the only one of my pupils who does not write my music. In fact, Vaughan Williams was one of the first composers of the new century who managed to forge a strong personal style almost exclusively from materials of the past. "My advice to young composers," he wrote, "is learn your own language first. Find out your own traditions. Discover what you want to do." The Lark Ascending, which Vaughan Williams composed in 1914, is indebted both to English folk song and to the composer's reading of the work of the English novelist and poet George Meredith. For much of his life, Vaughan Williams lived near Dorking, Surrey, not far from Meredith's beloved Box Hill, where the poet died crippled and nearly deaf in 1909. Vaughan Williams originally wrote The Lark Ascending as a short romance for violin and piano. The autograph is prefaced by lines from Meredith's poem, The Lark Ascending. When Vaughan Williams enlisted in the army in 1914 after the outbreak of World War I, he was 41 at the time, he set the score aside. The experience of serving in the war, he was an orderly with the Royal Army Medical Corps in France and then an officer, seems only to have heightened his nostalgia for a simpler time and for a world that no longer existed. It isn't surprising, then, that shortly after he came home in 1919, he picked up The Lark Ascending, lovingly fine-tuned it, and eventually orchestrated it as a touching souvenir of a time gone by. Even the song of the lark itself, which Vaughan Williams suggests in the flourishes of the solo violin, is now a rare thing, the bird's population in decline, and much of its natural habitat irrevocably spoiled. The Lark Ascending is one of the supreme achievements of English landscape painting. In a single sweep of velvety pastoral writing, Vaughan Williams extols the untroubled joys of nature, the call of the lark, and particularly in the animated middle section, the genial folk music of earlier times. Vaughan Williams prefaced his score with these lines from Meredith's poem. "He rises and begins to round. He drops the silver chain of sound of many links without a break in chirrup, whistle, slur, and shake. For singing till his heaven fills, 'tis love of earth that he instills, and ever winging up and up, our valley is his golden cup, and he the wine which overflows to lift us with him as he goes, till lost on his aerial rings in light, and then the fancy sings." Program notes by Philip Huscher on Vaughan Williams' The Lark Ascending. And now on to notes by guest annotator Daniel Jaffe on Benjamin Britten's Suite on English Folk Tunes, A Time There Was, the performance time, around 14 minutes. Early in 1933, 19-year-old Benjamin Britten happened to hear on the radio two brilliant folk song arrangements of Percy Grainger, which he wrote in his diary, knocked all the V. Williams and R. O. Morris arrangements into a cocked hat. Although Britten admired Vaughan Williams' wonderfully scored Tallis Fantasia, the older composer's cozy pastoral style was no match for the Australian's boldly individual and colorful arrangements. 25 years later, Britten finally met Grainger and made several attempts to have him perform at the festival he had founded in Aldborough. Their admiration was mutual. Grainger confessed himself in love with Britten's tragic and inspired setting of O Wali Wali, but events and ill health conspired to prevent Grainger appearing at Britten's festival. In the meantime, Britten and his partner, the tenor Peter Pears, often performed Grainger's folk song arrangements, Britten being a superlative pianist. For the 1966 Aldborough Festival, Britten organized a tribute to Percy Grainger, subsequently recording an album, Salute to Percy Grainger, himself playing piano and conducting the English Chamber Orchestra and the Ambrosian Singers in various works, which, when released in 1969, proved a landmark in raising the profile of Grainger's music. Britten's Suite on English Folk Tunes, his last completed orchestral work, again pays explicit tribute by presenting an entire folk tune, Lord Melbourne, which was originally, as Britten's prefatory note in the score says, written down in his usual meticulous detail by Percy Grainger, to whose memory the suite is lovingly and reverently dedicated. And there are quote marks around lovingly and reverently, unexplained by Britten, signifying a quote from Grainger's inscription in his own British folk music arrangements, lovingly and reverently dedicated to the memory of Edvard Grieg. Mostly composed late in 1974, Britten's Suite was completed on November 16th, less than a week before his own 61st birthday. He was by then seriously ill, having endured a less than successful heart operation that left him not only enfeebled, but also unable to play the piano. Yet one would hardly know this from music as vigorous as the suite's opening Cakes and Ale and its penultimate movement, Hunt the Squirrel. Britten had composed one of its movements as early as December 11th, 1966. Hank and Booby, scored for woodwind ensemble and tamburo, military drum, was originally written for the opening of London's Queen Elizabeth Hall on March 1st, 1967. Sounding robust and mischievous in that original context, Hank and Booby was considered for adaptation in a film about a rural Suffolk village's changing way of life after the First World War. But Britten's ill health intervened, and he finally made it the third movement of his Suite on English Folk Tunes. It took Britten some time to decide the suite's title. At one stage, he considered Up She Goes. Finally, after hearing a rebroadcast of Pears singing Britten's own song cycle setting of Thomas Hardy, Winter Words, the composer decided on his subtitle. The cycle ends with a setting of Before Life and After, which opens, A Time There Was, as one may guess, and as indeed Earth's testimonies tell, before the birth of consciousness, when all went well. All five movements are based on either English folk tunes, including the finale's Lord Melbourne, or country dances, the latter selected from John Playford's 17th century anthology, The Dancing Master. Marked fast and rough, Cakes and Ale is kick-started by timpani, launching a bouncy string motif based on the dance tune We'll Wed. Brass, punctuated by side drum, then take up the theme, followed by a scherzando episode for woodwinds before a return of the strings. Over the still scampering strings, woodwinds and horns then introduce a second, almost chorale-like theme, Stepney Cakes and Ale, broken up with a solo flourish from each member of the string family, violin, viola, after which trumpets join the merrymaking, cello, bass, and then violin again. Finally, a muted brass capitulation of the We'll Wed theme, and the movement peters out with an ascending solo violin. The Bitter Withy is based on two English folk tunes, one of them collected, as the score explicitly states, by Vaughan Williams at Wimbledon in September 1905 from the singing of Mr. Hunt. Might Britain have been belatedly making amends for his youthful contempt of that well-loved composer? Certainly he had started revising several of his opinions of English composers from previous generations, notably Elgar, whose music he conducted in stirring and revelatory performances recorded during the 1960s. Further, during the 1940s, after his return to Britain from his sojourn to the United States, there were hints in some of Britain's works, such as Rejoice in the Lamb, that he had absorbed some of Vaughan Williams' sound world. Now, in Bitter Withy, strings and harp spin an obviously pastoral texture, though it is the brief moment when the strings enter a dark-toned unison accompanied by the tolling of a lone bell that one senses most acutely a shadow cast by Vaughan Williams. Hank and Booby starts with a sinister-sounding jig played by oboes and clarinets, each phrase ending in a trill against which the dance melody, Half Henneken, is heard softly played in unison by pairs of flutes and bassoons. Although a major key melody, any potential brightness this might bring is quite sapped by the tone of the preceding theme. There follows a more perky woodwind idea based on the dance Mage on a Key. The movement ends with an enigmatic major chord. More rustic and apparently joyous is Hunt the Squirrel, a whirl of rapid fiddle playing, ringing with open strings, in which fragments of the dance tunes Hunt the Squirrel and the tuneful Nightingale suggest a riotous rustic gathering brought to a swift end. With Lord Melbourne marked slow and languid, we reach the heart of the suite, and on solo English horn, we hear the melody collected by Granger. As the late English critic Michael Oliver perceptively noted, the suite's longest movement is subdued, dark, and desolate, with something of protest to its climax. The movement finally gutters out with a low flute that tentatively finishes the melody. Notes by guest annotator Daniel Jaffe on Benjamin Britten's Suite on English Folk Tunes, A Time There Was. And now on to Haydn's Symphony No. 104, the London Symphony, a work lasting about 29 minutes. In 1795, the year he wrote this symphony, Joseph Haydn was the most popular composer alive. He had lost his good friend, valued colleague, and only real competition, Wolfgang Mozart, 4 years earlier. They last saw each other in Vienna a year before Mozart died, as Haydn was leaving for London, and both got misty-eyed, saying goodbye. Young Ludwig von Beethoven was still an unknown just 2 months before Haydn led the premiere of this symphony in London. Beethoven made his debut in Vienna, playing his B-flat piano concerto, and made everyone sit up and listen, in the words of one observer. It was almost a changing of the guard, because as Haydn gradually retired from public life, Beethoven, in a series of spectacular appearances, began to command the attention of the musical world as no composer before him. This D major symphony, the one we know as number 104, although the count isn't quite right, is the last one Haydn wrote. As the composer himself indicated on the title page, it's the 12th symphony he composed for London. After spending 30 years of his professional life at the court of the Esterházy family, Haydn was invited to London by Johann Peter Salomon, a fine violinist and a better impresario. Haydn left Vienna on December 15, 1790, and although the crossing was rough, "I fought it all off and came ashore without, excuse me, actually being sick," he wrote home. The reception from the London public was extraordinary. He was entertained like royalty, and each of the new symphonies he unveiled at Salomon's concerts was a triumph. When Haydn returned to Vienna in 1792, he found that word of his success had preceded him, and he was now famous even at home. He had become that rarest of 18th-century commodities and international celebrity. Negotiations began again with Salomon, and on January 19, 1794, Haydn made his second trip to London after promising to write 6 new symphonies. The D major symphony is the last of the bunch, and although Solomon's concert series was taken over by Giovanni Battista Viotti, Haydn's success was greater than ever. This symphony was first performed at a special benefit concert, the big event of the London season, on May 4, 1795. It probably was the single greatest concert of Haydn's career, certainly his share of the profits. 4,000 golden was unprecedented. "Such a thing is possible only in England," he wrote in his diary. Viotti's orchestra was 60 strong, a luxury Haydn apparently enjoyed. The review in the Morning Chronicle spoke freely of Haydn's genius and of the fullness, richness, and majesty of the symphony. We cannot be certain that Haydn knew he would never write another symphony, but this one, as well as any, stands as the summation of his achievement. It's a classic example in so many respects, beginning with the slow introduction that lays out all the symphony's materials in plain view without ever giving away the plot. It's in no way predictable, and there are no symphonies quite like it, not in Haydn's output, even with 106 others by current reckoning, and not from any other composer of the day. In the fast part of the first movement, Haydn manipulates the simple materials from the introduction like a true master. His imagination is so rich, we follow in amazement, his grasp so sure that we never for a moment doubt that he can pull it off. The Andante begins innocently and then delves deep into the heart. Haydn doesn't need to raise his voice to say the most astonishing things. Even knowing all the more outspoken music written in the following century, we still recognize this as emotional music, wide in its range and courageous in content. All 18th-century minuets sound the same until you hear Haydn's. He never tired of trying something different with the form. Here there are funny, offbeat accents, an unexpected timpani crescendo, and the surprise of moving straight from D major to B flat for the trio. The melody of the finale is said by some to be a Croatian song. Esterhaza, where Haydn had spent much of his time, sits amid Croatian villages, and by others to be the London street cry, "Hot cross buns." Mrs. Papendieck, whose London memoirs document her acute eye as well as her hopelessly muddled memory, recalls that one Haydn symphony, she says it was played in 1791, tossed the street cry, "Live cod," from instrument to instrument. Whether it's fish or fowl, Haydn treats the tune to a complete tour of the orchestra, and in one of the most astonishing technical demonstrations, proves again that the common man and the connoisseur can sit at the same table, that street music and the symphony are the same. There are tricks for the crowd and a flawless technique to disarm the critics. Poetry and wit abound. And with a few plain D major chords, the longest and most brilliant symphonic career we have ever known is over. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Haydn's Symphony No. 104, The London. I'm Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.